The liberal LaGuardia administration sought to diffuse Harlem's discontent by implementing many of his riot commission's recommendations. From 1936 to 1941, the administration backed the construction of two new Harlem schools, the Harlem River Houses Public Housing Complex and the Women's Pavilion at Harlem Hospital. LaGuardia consulted frequently with the black middle class moderate political elite, notably National Urban League Director Lester Granger and NAACP Executive Secretary Walter White. The mayor's attempts to build popularity among Harlem voters were recognized in February 1940 when the local branch of the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History honored him at the Schomburg Collection of the New York Public Library, praising him for, quote, efforts to improve race relations throughout the city. But LaGuardia's concessions did little to alter the widespread poverty and political discontent among the majority of Harlem's working class and unemployed. When the U.S. Supreme Court in 1938 declared that the public picketing of private businesses business establishments over racially based complaints was constitutional, a new round of Harlem protest ensued. The new Don't Buy Where You Can't Work coalition of 38 quickly won major concessions from white businesses. Within several years, about a third of all clerks and white-collar employees in Harlem were Negroes. In parallel efforts, blacks won employment concessions to work as telephone repairmen and operators, to drive buses for the Fifth Avenue and the New York omnibus companies, and to hold white-collar positions in Con Ed. What is most significant about Harlem's experiences during the 30s is that it established a model or pattern of social movement protest that would later be repeated. It would be replicated throughout the entire United States during the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s. Mass agitation by mostly grassroots associations, unions, and churches around racial grievances culminated first in a series of well-publicized public demonstrations, followed by urban insurrection. A liberal government supported by white and Negro elites, granting major concessions in the form of hospitals, public housing, and expanded Negro opportunities for employment in both the public and private sectors, which in turn created the political environment for the rise of new African American victories within the electoral arena, the courts, and government. That's the pattern. And the pattern really gets set and established not by King in the 50s, but by New York in the 30s and early 40s. It's really in New York in the 30s and 40s. That's the template of the modern civil rights movement. That's where it really emerges. Now, the chief beneficiary of these political reforms was the Reverend Adam Clayton Powell, Jr. Born in 1908, Powell was the son of the powerful pastor of Harlem's Abyssinian Baptist Church, Adam Clayton Powell, Sr., educated at Colgate University and Columbia University's Teachers College. Powell, Jr., following his father's footsteps, went into the ministry, but his overriding interests were hardly spiritual. In 1931, young Powell had led a protest at New York City's Board of Estimates, successfully halting the exclusion of five African-American physicians from practicing at Harlem Hospital. Powell then joined with Randolph and others to launch the Greater New York Coordinating Council for Employment, which used picketing and nonviolent protest and demonstrations, securing blacks' jobs. Succeeding his dad as head of Abyssinian in 1937, Powell possessed a strong religious constituency as well as a growing army of political supporters and volunteers for all of his many causes. Ideologically and politically, Powell was a pragmatic liberal. In Harlem, he worked frequently and closely with the U.S. Communist Party. At the national level, he endorsed Roosevelt's New Deal administration. Locally, he supported LaGuardia's re-election campaign as mayor in 1941. That same year, Powell established the People's Committee, a Harlem-based mass organization of 1,800 campaign workers in 8 offices dedicated to elect the charismatic minister to the New York City Council. Powell's challenge on his left and right, challengers, American Labor Party candidate Dr. Max Yergin, taught at City College on the left, and Republican candidate Channing Tobias, respectively, pulled out of the contest in Powell's favor. LaGuardia, of course, embraced and endorsed Powell, and the two liberals campaigned together, both achieving victory. Now, once elected to the city council, however, Powell astutely used the post to present Harlem's continuing grievances, much to the chagrin of a very surprised LaGuardia. When Yergin, a history instructor at the all-white City College, nearly all-white City College, located in West Harlem, was not reappointed to an academic position largely on political grounds of his rumored affiliation with the U.S. Communist Party, Powell introduced on February 1941 Resolution Number 31, demanding the banning of racial discrimination in academic appointments. In May 1942, Powell's organization sponsored a mass protest rally at the Golden Gate Ballroom to denounce the New York Police Department's brutality in the beating and killing of a black man, Walter Armstrong. In January 1943, when the LaGuardia administration gave the U.S. Navy permission to establish training facilities for the racially segregated Women's Reserve, the WAVES, at Manhattan's Hunter College, and at Walton High School, Powell denounced the action as a hypocritical capitulation to the federal government's Jim Crow policies. Powell's positions echoed those favored by civil rights organizations, black labor, and the communists, and represented by their double V campaign, victory over fascism abroad and racism at home, the double V campaign. In response to Negroes' modest gains in employment, thousands of white workers participated in hate strikes during these years, demanding the exclusion of Negroes, especially in skilled positions. Just a few examples. In July 1943, white racists briefly paralyzed Baltimore's Bethlehem shipyards at Sparrows Point. Only the resolute actions of the liberal Congress of Industrial Organizations, CIO unions, that were involved as shipbuilders, electricians, and steelworkers suppressed this hate strike. In August of 1944, Philadelphia white streetcar workers, enraged at the assignment of 8 Negro motormen, staged a 6-day strike shutting down public transportation in Philadelphia during the war. President Roosevelt was forced to dispatch 5,000 troops into Philly declared an executive order placing the streetcar company under army control. None of these disturbing events was lost upon the African-American community in Harlem, who in growing numbers questioned their participation and support in America's war effort. Years later, in The Fire Next Time, Jimmy Baldwin would reflect, quote, "The treatment according to the Negro during the Second World War marks for me a turning point in the Negro's relationship to America. A certain hope died, a certain respect for white Americans faded," unquote. Thousands of young African-American males simply refused to register for the draft. Others sought to disqualify themselves from military service due to health or other disabilities. One obscure black religious sect, calling itself the Nation of Islam, led by a man who later identified himself to the FBI as Elijah Muhammad, openly urged its followers to refuse to register for the draft. Just as a footnote, keep in mind Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali, opposing the war in Vietnam. This is a harbinger of things to come. Right? September 1942, the FBI rounded up nearly 100 Negro Americans for draft resistance or evasion. The defendants belonged to 3 organizations, the Nation of Islam, a Brotherhood of Liberty for Black People in America, and another group, the Peace Movement of Ethiopia. The majority of those arrested, however, claimed to be Muslims. 56 defendants were tried, convicted, and received 3-year prison terms. One son of Elijah Muhammad, Emmanuel Karim, was given 5 years. Elijah Muhammad himself was charged, the 46-year-old man, was charged with sedition. Following his conviction, Elijah Muhammad remained incarcerated in federal prison until his release in August 1946. On April the 22nd, 1943, the doors of Harlem's Savoy Ballroom were padlocked by the NYPD on the grounds that allegedly servicemen had been solicited for prostitution on its premises. The Savoy's closing had been prompted by Assistant Police Commissioner Cornelius O'Leary, who had claimed that his actions were prompted by concerns over public health. New York City's Bureau of Social Hygiene had provided evidence to O'Leary that over a 9-month period in 1942, 43,164 individuals, quote, have met the source of their venereal disease in the Savoy Ballroom, unquote. These alleged cases came from the Army, Navy, Marines, and Coast Guard personnel. As historian Russell Gold has accurately observed, quote, this is suspect testimony because, in understatement, because no evidence was provided explaining how they knew their servicemen or other citizens had contracted their diseases from prostitutes at the Savoy instead of from their wives, girlfriends, or contacts with prostitutes elsewhere, unquote. When on April the 20th, 1943, the Appellate Division of the New York State Supreme Court ruled unanimously to uphold O'Leary's actions, LaGuardia declared he was powerless to stop the Savoy's closing. The Savoy Ballroom controversy continued to swirl, and the Savoy remained closed throughout the summer in the early fall of 1943. The police announced on October 15th, 43, that the establishment's license had been renewed and that the Savoy's grand reopening would occur on October the 22nd, 1943. To Malcolm Little, the closing of the Savoy was clear evidence of the limitations of white liberalism's toleration toward interracial sex. Quote, during World War II, Mayor LaGuardia officially closed the Savoy Ballroom. Malcolm wrote, Harlem said the real reason was to stop Negroes from dancing with white women. Harlem said no one dragged white women in here in the first place. Adam Clayton Powell made it a big fight. He had successfully fought Consolidated Edison and the New York Telephone Company until they hired Negroes. Then he had helped to battle the U.S. Navy and the U.S. Army about their segregating of uniformed Negroes. But Powell couldn't win this battle. City Hall kept the Savoy closed for a long time. It was just another one of the liberal North actions that didn't help Harlem to love the white man any, unquote. Only weeks following the Savoy Ballroom's closing in May 1943, the LaGuardia administration made public its agreement with Metropolitan Life Insurance Company to construct Stuyvesant Town, a semi-public housing complex located on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. Metropolitan Life had received from the city generous tax exemptions, eminent domain authority, and control over tenant selection. When it became clear that MetLife intended to bar Negro tenants, African Americans and many white liberals were outraged and appalled at the LaGuardia administration. They couldn't believe it. Powell accused LaGuardia of capitulating to white supremacy. His newspaper boldly editorialized, Hitler won a victory in New York City. At one mass rally attended by 20,000 supporters, Powell demanded LaGuardia's impeachment. It was not until 44 that LaGuardia brokered a compromise. Stuyvesant Town was constructed under the original terms with MetLife. However, the mayor signed Local Law Numbers 20, barring all racial discrimination in tenant selection in future housing projects constructed under the city's authority by private corporations. When the Detroit race riot of June 2021, 1943 erupted, New York City's authorities should have recognized that the conditions for similar insurrection were ripe in Harlem. In only its first 6 hours, the toll from Detroit's unrest amounted to 34 deaths, 700 injured, $2 million in property damage. 5,000 federal troops were necessary to patrol the city streets in Detroit. Harlem's turn came on August 1st, 1943, when a police officer shot a black serviceman in uniform, Robert Bandy, who was attempting to protect an African-American woman. And I'm going to cut material here a bit. Within minutes, general rioting erupted. White-owned businesses along 125th Street and on Harlem's major north-south boulevards, Lenox Avenue, 7th and 8th Avenues, north from Central Park up to 145th Street, were attacked. Before midnight, 1,450 stores had been vandalized. Six were dead, 200 injured, 600 Negroes incarcerated by the NYPD. Significantly, unlike the 35 riot, eyewitness accounts of the 1943 insurrection describe the rioters as being both of lower class incomes, lower income blacks, and middle class Negroes. Even one 1943 police report of the riot admitted, quote, "Those actually committing malicious acts of violence were irresponsible, ignorant individuals. But the probability is that many decent citizens were in various groups who, in the most instances, are intelligent and law-abiding, and while not actually taking part in the physical disturbances, aided and abetted indirectly in said disturbances," unquote. That afternoon, according to the autobiography, Malcolm Little was strolling south on St. Nick Avenue when he observed Negroes running uptown, quote, "loaded down with armfuls of stuff." According along West 125th Street, Malcolm soon learned, quote, "Negroes were smashing store windows and taking everything they could grab and carry, furniture, food, jewelry, clothes, whiskey." Within an hour, the NYPD had dispatched what to Malcolm appeared to be, quote, "every New York City cop into Harlem." Malcolm colorfully described the semi-comic scene of NAACP leader Walter White accompanying Mayor LaGuardia driving along 125th Street in a bright red fire car, pleading over loudspeakers to all of those shouting, milling, angry Negroes to please go home and stay inside. Malcolm probably would have agreed with much of Powell's analysis on the causes of the rioting. Quote, "when Bandy had resisted the police officer, he was not mad with him only for arresting a colored woman, but he was mad with every white policeman in the United States who had consistently beaten, wounded, and often killed colored men and women without provocation. When they were smashing windows, they thought they were breaking the skulls of race haters and race baiters," unquote. It is from that vantage point of Harlem's mounting racial grievances, unemployment, discrimination, widespread unemployment, the closing of the Savoy, Stuyvesant Town controversy, the August 1943 race riot, that Malcolm Little's actions regarding his own military induction must be considered. In the autobiography, Malcolm recalled Shorty Jarvis's attitude, that's his homeboy, his best friend, attitude about the outbreak of World War II, approvingly, quote, "Whitey owns everything. He wants us to go and bleed for him. Let him fight," quote unquote. Although the autobiography makes no mention of it, Malcolm Little may have heard about the well-publicized case of an African-American, Winifred W. Lynn, who had refused to be inducted in September 1942 because of his opposition to racially segregated military units. Lynn eventually lost his case, but his protest had provoked widespread sympathy among African Americans and a great debate about the war effort in the Negro press nationwide. By 1943-44, dissent among blacks within the armed services was also escalating. Hundreds of black soldiers simply were going AWOL from their segregated units. There were also an unusually high number of casualties experienced by white officers of segregated Negro units, fragging officers. When the military induction notice addressed to Malcolm Little arrived at his sister Ella's house in Boston, she informed authorities that her half-brother no longer resided there. When Malcolm eventually received the notice of induction, he became quickly determined to avoid military service by any means necessary. The Legend of Detroit Red depicted in the autobiography, presents a classic trickster tale of guile, deception, and ultimate vindication for our hero. Quote, "I had about 10 days before I was to show up at the induction center. I went right to work." Malcolm knew that Harlem was filled with military intelligence officers. Quote, "those black spies in civilian clothes." He spread out the word, sent out the word on the streets that, quote, "I was frantic to join the Japanese army." On the date of the scheduled induction, October 25th, 1943, Malcolm wrote, quote, "I costumed like an actor with my wild zoot suit. I wore the yellow knob-toed shoes, and I frizzed my hair up in a bush of conch." He addressed one white soldier sitting at the receptionist desk. "Crazy-o, daddy-o, get me moving. I can't wait to get into that brown." Eventually pulled from the induction line, the zoot-suited hustler was interrogated by a military psychiatrist to determine his fitness to serve. Malcolm rambled incessantly, and then astutely whispering into the psychiatrist's ear, Malcolm said, "Daddy-o, now you and me, we're up north here. So don't you tell nobody. I want to get sent down south. Organize them nigger soldiers, you dig? Steal some guns and kill us some crackers." The psychiatrist, stunned, senseless, uttered, "That will be all." The military psychiatrist then judged Malcolm Little 4F. Unfit for military duty. Quote, "a 4F card came to me in the mail," Malcolm said proudly, "and I never heard from the U.S. Army ever again and never bothered to ask why I was rejected." That's the memoir. Here's the historian. A subsequent FBI report dated January 28, 1955, confirms that Malcolm Little was indeed rejected. And this is what it says, quote, "the subject was found mentally disqualified for military service for the following reasons: psychopathic personality, inadequate, sexual perversion, psychiatric rejection. Subject was classified 4F on December 4th, 1944, unquote. The FBI memorandum suggests that certain elements of Detroit Red's trickster tale, the issue of sexual perversion, were deleted from Malcolm's own version of what had transpired that day. There was also a certain connection between the zoot-suited performance Malcolm Little had displayed at the induction center and his sandwich red routine that he had successfully maintained for months on the railroad. Both were disingenuous displays of black buffoonery designed to achieve different goals: financial reward, and a permanent deferment from military service. But both costume personas directly repudiated the militant, black, strong model of his assertive dead father. They also contradicted Malcolm's own political attitudes and evolving social consciousness, especially in the wake of the 1943 Harlem race riot. The hustler's creed of getting over through the art of deception fundamentally conflicted with the political heritage of Malcolm's parents. Ultimately, Malcolm Little would have to decide which model of black masculinity and black politics he would claim as his own. The conclusion. Malcolm Little's actual time living and working in Harlem was relatively brief, from January 1942 until October 1944. It's not even 3 years. Yet it was long enough for him to become a Harlemite for the rest of his life, a lover of jazz music and black popular culture, an astute ethnographer of people and their surroundings in urban settings, a hustler who found his way to survive during the hardest and most challenging economic times, a political observer with a deep distrust of government, the police, and all institutions of white authority and white power. Although he did not participate directly in Harlem's political activities during these years, Malcolm had witnessed the community struggles around the Savoy Ballroom's closing. He had seen the 1943 Harlem race riot and the role of black middle-class leaders such as Walter White in attempting to suppress black insurrection. As Detroit Red's friend Clarence Atkins recalled in 1992, quote, "He was always political, always. Even in the midst of all that street hustling and everything else he was doing, Malcolm Little was political." The man who was Detroit Red celebrated and created a kind of image of a Bugsy Siegel gangster that did not exist. It's not really in the criminal record. And the purpose for that was to show the transformative power, at first, of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and the creed of the Nation of Islam. But after breaking with Elijah Muhammad and the NOI and embracing a humanistic world religion and a faith in the humanity of all people, Malcolm then saw the narrative serving a very different purpose, a purpose that says that through faith and through a commitment to struggle, that human beings can transcend the color line. Detroit Red is not a detour. He's an essential part of the man who would become one of the most extraordinary figures of the 20th century. But he was also a product of, I would argue, the most extraordinary urban site in the history of people of African descent. Because without Harlem, there would be no Malcolm X. Thank you.